All good things must come to an end. I'm Doc Coleman, and this is the final installment of the Balticon 46 wrap-up from Swimming Cat Studios. Thank you for listening along with us. I hope that this has whet your appetite for Balticon 47, and that we'll see you there. Our final episode was recorded on Monday, May 28th at 2 p.m. This event wasn't a panel, but a set of readings from Gary Lester of Channel 37, myself, and Yoji Kondo. We've decided to divide the reading up into three parts, with separate audio tracks for each reading. The Channel 37 guys will be putting their portion up on their site, and we didn't want to interfere with their release. Mr. Yoji Kondo employed a stunt reader, as his accent is rather thick. This actually makes some of the discussion about his reading a bit painful to some ears, so for those who would rather not try to puzzle through the conversation, that reading is in a separate file on my server and will not be dropped into this feed. You can find links to the audio for both of these readings in the show notes for this episode. The audio that follows is my reading, an excerpt from the first draft of my steampunk novel, The Perils of Prague, the first of the adventures of Crackle and Bang. At the time this episode was released, I was still working on revisions to the novel, but this section will give you an idea of what you can expect when it is published. I hope you enjoy it, and you'll look for my novel when it finally goes on sale. Thank you for coming to our reading. My name is Doc Coleman, and my reading selection here is from a novel which I'm currently working on, which is called The Perils of Prague. It's one of the Adventures of Crackle and Bang, which is also a new series that I'm working on. This particular selection is actually the third chapter, although I'm still in editing, and I have a feeling it's probably going to end up being the second chapter, but... At this point, we're following a young English lord who's doing a grand tour of the world, and he was supposed to meet with his uncle in his uncle's private box at the opera, and instead he finds a gentleman and a lovely young lady who claim to be associates of his uncle. But he's never met them before, and they explain that the uncle has been detained. And so we begin with Chapter 3, A Most Peculiar Solo. I'm told that opinion is divided over the best place in the house to watch opera. On one hand are those who view the performance as a theatrical presentation. For them, the ideal seats are as close to the center of the opera house as possible, so that they may see the entire stage and the full play of the performers in their roles. The drawback of this approach is that one is either seated in amongst the press of the crowd or in a box in the back of the theater and unable to watch the show without the aid of glasses. Another camp, one to which my uncle adheres, holds that the most prestigious seats are near the stage, so that the notes are clear and crisp, and one can catch the subtleties of the performance close up. Naturally, the drawback of this approach is that one must either be on one side of the stage or the other, and unable to see details on the far side of the stage. Yet another following puts forth that the best seats are determined by the acoustics of the particular opera house, and the performance is best enjoyed by closing one's eyes while in one of those seats, and savoring the nuances of sound as they pour over you. I have always been in a fourth camp, one that believes that the best place to listen to opera is in a cafe 2 miles from the opera house, fortified with a few bottles of wine and some attractive female company. From this vantage point, one should strain to hear the opera over the lively music of a local band, and completely fail in the attempt.
In this regard, I was, by my own lights, much too close to the performance, lacking in the proper social lubricant, and failing abysmally with being unable to hear the orchestra or the squawking of the performers. The only manner in which this experience was successful was in my female companionship, and even that was marred by the presence of a chaperone behind me, and the ladies' rapt attention upon the actual performance. Under other circumstances, I would probably have contented myself to simply sit and watch Miss Bang breathe, while allowing my imagination to wander along the curves and valleys of her form. But even this entertainment was denied me by the awareness of the gentleman behind me, and the possibility that he might actually be an acquaintance of my uncle, and able to dramatically impact my future freedom with a casual word of disapproval. As this worry nagged at the corners of my mind, I had little choice but to settle myself in for a miserable evening, punctuated by stolen peeks from the corner of my eye at my, well, corseted companion. Sitting in the dark, listening to the troupe belting out incomprehensible German lyrics, and fretting about how to approach Miss Bang without incurring censorship from her employer or my uncle, quite effectively dampened the excitement I had originally experienced upon meeting her. After a few songs, I was finding it difficult to keep my eyes open, and was beginning to catch myself as I started drifting off to sleep in my seat. I was stirred from this shaky slumber by the soaring volume of the female lead in the course of an aria that I presume was supposed to signal the end of the first act. I blinked my eyes open and sat up to see the two leads alone on the stage. He was frozen in place with a pained look upon his face, no doubt intended to portray some heartfelt emotion. She pranced in front of him, pouring her heart out to the audience in what sounded to my ears like a banshee wail. Sleep firmly chased away by her caterwauling, I attempted to focus my attention on the performance once again. The singer struck a pose with her arms flung wide and filled the opera house with a single sustained note. And then her face shifted. The right side of her face slid down about an inch, and the pitch of her note shot upwards, sounding more like a factory whistle than a human voice. Throughout the theater, patrons sat forward in their seats, trying to understand what had happened. The two performers remained frozen in their positions, seemingly oblivious to the incongruity of the situation. Professor Crackle surged to his feet behind me. He crowded to the rail of the box, blocking the aisle next to me. "It can't be," he cried. "I didn't even think it was possible." He was clearly excited about this turn of events. While I must admit that the situation was more lively than the previous entertainment, it still grated upon my ears. "What is happening?" I cried over the keening steam whistle sound. "I can't tell from up here," he answered. "I need to get down there." He looked about briefly, as if expecting a stairwell to appear before him. Then he turned and leaned over me, grabbing a cane from the seat behind Miss Bang. As I straightened myself up to protest his behavior, he turned back to the stage and used the cane to climb up upon the balcony rail. "Are you mad, man?" I screamed out and lurched to my feet, grabbing for the strangely attired man. Before I could reach him, he jumped from the rail of the balcony, diving into the thick velvet curtains at the edge of the stage. Grabbing a double armful of the heavy curtain, he arrested his fall and slid to the stage below in a controlled manner. Miss Bang joined me at the rail of my uncle's box, and I shared a confused look with her, all thoughts of romance dashed in the current chaos. "What does he think he is up to?" I asked her. She simply shrugged her shapely shoulders and spread her empty hands out before her. The professor skidded across the stage, still clutching his cane in one hand. He slid to a stop beside the soloist and peered at her deformed face. He reached out to touch her, but before he could, her cheek slid down another inch, making a bizarre figure eight of her mouth. With this motion, the keening abruptly stopped, and steam began to vent out through the woman's nose and mouth, forcing the professor to stagger back half a step. At the abrupt silence, the male soloist finally moved, going down on one knee on the stage, bracing his hand against the floor, and then opening his mouth to utter a low, sustained note. I momentarily wondered that the man continued his performance in the light of all this chaos, and then realized that the man's jaw must have displaced itself, so wide had he opened his jaw. His note rumbled forth and seemed to reverberate back at us from the walls. It seemed to come from the walls. In a few seconds we began to hear the tinkling of gaslight chandeliers as they began to shake on the ends of their chains. We all looked about in confusion. We could no longer hear the man singing as a separate sound. It had now blended into a background rumble that permeated the building. The floors and walls began to shake, and the chandeliers began to swing more violently. Professor Crackle had returned to our side of the stage. He was yelling at us and gesturing with his hands, but the sound of his voice was swallowed by the reverberating noise that pulsed through the entire opera house. He raised one hand in frustration and almost smacked himself in the head with his own cane. He looked at his cane with sudden surprise and then began running his hands over it, twisting and pulling at the filigreed decorations on its sides. Grabbing a silver ring on the cane, he slid it towards the foot, and the sides of the cane swung out and bloomed into a massive cone. He raised the top of the cane to his mouth, pointing the other end out over the audience. His voice now came booming through the growing rumble, somehow amplified by the apparatus concealed in his cane. "Run, you fools! The whole thing is going to come down! Get out while you can!" For a split second, no one moved. And then a section of catwalk crashed to the stage behind the professor. The impact of the falling planks hitting the stage broke the audience out of their shock. They leapt to their feet and began to push their way to the exits, panic screams punctuating their progress. I raised my hands to my mouth to ask again, "Professor, what is going on?" But I had barely begun speaking when I was hit hard across the shoulders and knocked bodily over the rail of the box. I flew into the curtains much as the professor had just done. Panic drove my reactions and I scrambled for a purchase on the thick curtain, but no sooner had I grabbed onto a handful of fabric than my weight yanked it out of my hands. Instead of coming to a controlled landing on the stage, I paused momentarily in the folds of the curtain and then slammed hard against the boards of the stage. I regained my wind with a shuddering breath and tried to stagger back to my feet. The professor appeared at my side and helped me to rise. I could barely hear him as he yelled to me, "I can't shut them off! You're going to have to take Miss Bang out the backstage entrance!" The debris from the stage area continued to fall as the building shook. There was a brief flash of light as one of the chandeliers pulled free of its supporting chains, the burning gas flaming and then going out as it crashed into the empty seats below. The orchestra had disappeared, leaving behind the larger instruments that could not be carried with them. The patrons that had not yet managed to clear the exits pushed harder against their fellows in an attempt to rush out the doors. I turned back to the box I had just vacated, in time to see Miss Bang leap from the rail and curl herself around the edge of the thick velvet curtain. The motion wrapped the fabric around her, taking her momentarily from our sight. But as she spun back, she gracefully slid down to the stage. She disengaged from the curtain and stepped towards us, handing the professor a black top hat that appeared to have two sets of goggles wrapped around the body of the hat. We struggled to stay on our feet now. The very floor seemed to heave up underneath us like a raging sea. Huge chunks of masonry now began to detach themselves from the walls and ceiling, bombarding the abandoned seats and filling the air with chips of wood, plaster, and brick. "Go! Run! Now!" the professor screamed, his voice barely registering to my ears in the cacophony. We tried to turn ourselves backstage, but holes began to appear in the bucking floor as the trap doors in the stage broke their latches and fell open in front of us. Waves of scenery and curtains crashed down around us as the rigging that secured them to the walls and ceiling of the theater pulled free. We held onto one another in an attempt to find stability as we struggled to head backstage without falling into a pit or being swept away by descending scenery. As we scrambled over the fallen curtains and tangled ropes in an attempt to vacate the stage, the pervasive rumble was broken momentarily by a massive crack. I looked back towards the source of the noise and witnessed the line of luxury boxes opposite us pitch forward and tumble to the floor with a tremendous crash. A cloud of dust and particulates blossomed out from the crash, pushing past the still unmoving opera singers and briefly blinding me as it struck my disbelieving eyes. I stumbled as I sought to clear my vision, but the hands of my companions held me up, attempting to keep me moving in the direction of the door. I cleared my eyes and looked up to gain my bearings. We had moved to the back of the stage and could at last see the exit before us. But before we could take a step further, the walls around us crumbled, and the roof of the opera house came crashing down, throwing us into darkness.
What's your earthquake based on?
Actually, it's not based on an earthquake.
Oh.
This is a steampunk work, and the opera singers are actually not singers. They've been replaced with clockwork replicants that had sonic weapons built in, and one of them did a harmonic resonance to collapse the building.
Pretty evil so, people, huh?
Yes, yes. And there's a whole lot more of this in here. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So...
All right, how do you want to do this?
Can
we flip a coin, you call it, or you want to just go, or I can just go, or... I'm good anyway.
I'll let you go ahead and go first.
You want me to go first?
So,
I will go first. And I'll
mind recording?
No.
Okay.
Just as a being anal about this, I was planning on doing a 15-minute reading.
That's fine.
Okay, because I figured three by...
Three people, we're looking at about, you know, 2,500 words to 3,000 words, 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah. Right. So, we'll see what happens afterwards. Okay, but I'll go 15 minutes or so. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of it. Thank you to everyone for coming to our reading. Enjoy the rest of your con. What little there is left.
the last 10 seconds.
Yes.
Just the closing ceremony.
Those are all 10 minutes on.
Well, there is at least one more panel on that's kind of a Balticon review. What you liked, what you didn't like. I know that one's there.
I want to take one of these.
Certainly. I've got cards and buttons up here if anyone would like them. Unfortunately, they're not from my writing. They're from my tech blog and my weight loss podcast. But that's the stuff I had materials for.
Does it have a microphone in it?